December Tynwald extended into her third day with members keen to milk every minute of debating time as we enter election year. Questions strayed into lively debates on the state of the Manx economy and support for first-time buyers. The first question was put to the Chief Minister.
It would be fair to say that based on some of the questioning that you had, particularly surrounding the Manx economy, the island is going to hell in a handcart. Is that fair?
Well, let's be clear, the questioning was really based around the money vowel assessment and some of the difficulties that we are finding just in terms of ensuring that everybody is fully prepared. And when I say difficulties, I think it was more about some of the concern that's been expressed by business that we are moving into a period of adversarial regulation and over-regulation. And that really fundamentally lay at the heart of the question.
And is there a fair point there? I mean, is there a risk sometimes that we're so keen to comply with all the regulations and the suggestions that are made to us that we regulate to such an extent that we can't actually see the glaringly obvious things that are going wrong because there's so much regulation in place?
Look, I think we're engaged in quite a tricky exercise. The bottom line is the FATFA assessment, the money vowel assessment that will come forward is not just about the technical regulations that are in place, but it is also asking for demonstrable evidence of our enforcement capability as well, and we'll look for evidence that enforcement capability has been properly utilised. There is also some upgrades required to the legislation, which points to more individual accountability. And of course, this has caused levels of consternation in business. But, you know, we do need to work together to get through this. It is important that we pass this money vowel assessment and that we get through with flying colours. I think there is a clear case and a clear argument being put forward that the regulators and the interpretation of the requirements by MoneyVal needs to be looked at in the right context in terms not just adversarial approach, but also understanding how we work together to ensure that we can build the economy and the economic success that we need moving forward.
Because, of course, some of this is down to proportionality, isn't it? I don't think anyone could argue that having rules and regulations in place to try and deal with potentially fraudulent large transactions is a good thing. But when we're talking about relatively small charities with turnovers of £200 or £300 a year, there has to be some level of proportionality in the way these things are done.
Yeah, absolutely. And let's not take the conversation down to a level of minutiae that's probably not relevant to the broader context of what we're discussing. Look, I think, you know, we are working together. We are business and government and the agencies involved are being brought together now in a more forceful way to engage and to be able to express opinions, understand where the difficulties lie and to seek to try and overcome those. I think that's important. I think it is important, and I do believe everybody is focused on passing the assessment. So, you know, that's a clear commitment from business, industry and government. But also there is a requirement to ensure that we are also engaged on a pathway for economic success into the future. And we need to learn and understand how to do that, both by interpreting the regulations correctly and ensuring they're enforced, but also by looking at the opportunities as well and getting the right balance into all our thought processes. So, you know, I'm very keen to see both the FSA and the GSC properly engaged in that front in terms of their recognition. They have a role to play in terms of building the economy as well, not just policing their individual sectors. And of course, you know, in a very competitive world where we have seen some decline in one or two of our business sectors, particularly most notably e-gaming, that we are also, you know, supporting our existing businesses and looking to encourage and develop the new business opportunities that are clearly out there in a very fast-moving world, which is very competitive, but also, you know, from year to year, from month to month, opportunities do occur, and we need to be ready to capitalise on those.
Mr. Hooper and Mr. Thomas particularly were questioning the success of the Manx economy and suggesting that if measures of GNP rather than GDP were used, we would see declining figures in terms of the overall performance of the economy. Is that a fair assessment that they've made?
Well, I think that a lot of what is being expressed at the moment, not just by the members in Timor, but outside, is of sentiment, right? I mean, that's absolutely clearly quite a difficult sentiment and a sentiment that the economy is not in the place that it needs to be. And there's a lot of pressures around, and some of those pressures have been caused by historic issues that have been... that have effectively impacted our economy, but also, you know, there's some frustrations around the process that's been undergone in terms of the sort of regulatory changes at the moment, and clearly you can see the friction around things like minimum wage and that changes that have been brought in that respect. So I think there's more sentiment than there is actual evidence. We are particularly slow at getting the real data out, and so, you know, I really would like to see the latest data figures. We tend to be going back 2 years really to see these sorts of GNP and GDP figures, so I'd like to see much more up-to-date figures being brought forward. I am under no illusions personally that we are in quite a difficult period at the moment. I think there's going to be a lot of emphasis in terms of what the budget does in February, and you know, I think I'm going to be clear with you. I am working with both ministers, the Treasury Minister and the Enterprise Minister, to understand how the economy needs to be stimulated at the moment and taken forward so that we can get some confidence back in, both into business, but also into the broader economic perceptions and sentiments that are clearly out there at the moment.
I guess you must be frustrated that, you know, we you set off with a fairly clear vision as to what you wanted to see, and I suppose events have maybe conspired a little bit against you, but we don't appear to have had the significant economic growth that I think your government had hoped for when it set off just over 4 years ago.
Well, again, data on that is not right up to date, so it's hard for me to give you an accurate figure without just sort of making a perceived comment. But look, there is data though, in terms of the numbers coming to the island, which is positive, the numbers of people in work, which is positive, the numbers of people unemployed, which remains incredibly low, which will give you a significant source of encouragement. Most of the people coming here to the island at the moment, and bear in mind it is in positive equity in terms of numbers coming, are under 50 years old. There's quite a large proportion of those people also under 34 years of age, in direct rebuttal to this ridiculous article from the TUC last week. So there is some positive indicators out there in terms of how the economy is performing, but there are also a lot of clear weaknesses, and perhaps I don't need data all the time, but you can certainly get that from speaking to businesses and constituents, which I do on a regular basis. So I recognize all the issues at the moment. Solving them sometimes is harder, but I wouldn't like to say, you know, I think there is a risk that we're just going to talk ourselves into a recession here, when the actual truth of the matter is that it's difficult. However, there's still opportunity in some sectors of our business community. There is clear evidence of success. The domestic economy, a bit harder.
And I imagine you could point to things like the Moody's credit rating that's recently been announced, that Moody's seem quite positive about where the economy is likely to be heading.
Well, a lot of external commentators, independent of the sort of usual business group or outside of our internal assessment mechanisms, give a very positive outlook. And in fact, when you compare the island to what is going on around us in many other neighbouring countries, actually, we seem to be in a relatively secure place. We don't have the levels, for example, of youth unemployment, which they are now seeing in the United Kingdom. We do not have significant security or crime issues. We do not have significant homelessness issues, which they have, for example, in Ireland. And therefore, there's a number of really significant core issues going on around us that the Iron Man has so far remained relatively protected from. So I think we shouldn't, think that we live in this some sort of bubble and that somehow the Iron Man is immune from global pressures around us. I think you have to put into context. If you compare our performance with everybody around us, I think on the whole, the figures and the information that we have would indicate that the economy is doing all right. That's not necessarily to mean to say that everybody's feeling that sort of success and that there aren't problems. But let's not talk ourselves into a sort of recession position when the truth is, there's no evidence to support that.
That was Eyre and Michael MHK, Alf Cannon. Next, we hear from DOI member Laurie Hooper.
You had supplementary questions to the Chief Minister in relation to the question about the Moneyval assessments. You're still sort of pushing, I think it was you that was pursuing this line, that the Isle of Man by GNP reckoning is in recession.
So I think the issue is it's a bit deeper than that. So you can't just look at one metric and assume that's going to tell you everything you need to know, and it doesn't. The problem that you have at the moment is there's lots of metrics and lots of indicators all pointing to structural weaknesses. So GDP is dropping, GNP is dropping, so the overall level of what we're producing is going down, and partly that's, contractions in industry and things, but it's dropping. But we're also seeing an increase in the number of jobs. Well, actually, those two things don't align. So if we're seeing more jobs but less stuff being produced, you're seeing productivity go down, so then it indicates low value jobs being added. That's not necessarily a good thing. So you need to look at the picture in the round and say, actually, what is really going on out there? And it's a complex thing to understand. Fine. The question this morning was, does government understand it? And rather than coming back saying, yes, actually, we've got our economist on it, we've got some reports, we've done an analysis, we understand what's going on, the answer that came back from the chief was underwhelming at best. But it seems that when he starts talking, he can articulate some of what's going on out there. So there must be an understanding in government, in Treasury, in enterprise as to what's really happening out there and isn't just being glossed over by headline figures. And that's what I think I'm trying to get to the bottom of, is does government have a handle on what's really going on out there in the economy? And I'm not convinced they do at this moment in time.
Is this an internal struggle or battle perhaps going on in council ministers, which of course we never get to really understand, you only get little hints at? Is that what's the problem here, that there's maybe a split in council as to what they think the answer is?
I don't know. It's the honest answer to that. I honestly think that they don't know what the answer is, and I think that's my overriding concern. So we have a tax policy that's supposed to help drive economic growth and support public finances, but actually that's based on what exactly? If they don't know how the economy is functioning and what's going on, you can't have a good tax policy, you can't have good minimum wage policy, you can't have good business support policy, you can't have good benefits policy. If you don't know what's really going on, all you're really doing is throwing things at a dartboard and seeing what sticks, and then afterwards going, oh yeah, we made that change and something happened over here that we didn't expect. And that's worrying, and I think that's the thing that concerns me the most, is we just had a debate on Treasury's department plan, and in there they say they've got this analysis and this information, but I've never seen it. I don't think council ministers have ever seen it, and the chief minister saying, well, we do publish all of our economic data, I think he's missed the point. Some of the data is out there, but no one has sat down and actually done that analysis work to better inform that ability to make policy, and that is quite concerning, because they're doing all sorts of big things. You've got Moneyval, you've got new reporting stuff for finance and e-gaming and crypto assets, there's all sorts of stuff going on, and they're proposing to launch an AI office, and they're looking to launch foundations bills. There's all sorts of stuff happening out there, but actually I've never seen anyone take a step back and go, right, what is the state of play today, and what is the impact on that going to be if we do XYZ? If we put the tax rates up by 1% or lower national insurance by 1%, what will that do to the economy? I don't think they've got that level of analysis.
You answered two questions. The minister was absent, DOI minister, and you answered in her part. First, question that you answered was in relation to the ongoing sort of revenue costs, I suppose, of the Isle of Man ferry terminal in Liverpool. Was it £700,000 you mentioned?
Yeah, give or take, that's the figure. And that I think is the kind of all-inclusive cost with a bit of contingency in there as well. And I think as part of the answer as well, we talked a little bit about what we think is going to happen over the next few years, and we know there'll be some changes following, you know, changes to UK RPI and other things. So, but broadly speaking, I think that's the cost.
What was you also said was this was to be paid for from Treasury, supplementing the department's budget. Is there no income associated with the new ferry terminal in Liverpool?
So there will be. So at the moment, the revenue funding comes out of the department's budget, but it's always been the intention that actually it'll be the steam packet as the user of the terminal that will pay for that. So when the lease negotiations are all finished, as part of that, there'll be a cost agreed, and the steam packet will pay that over to the department or the Treasury. So yes, the intention is it will be funded by the commercial arrangements that will be in place with the steam packet, rather than it being funded by the taxpayer, because ultimately, if we're going to run a commercial arm's length organisation like the steam packet, we should treat them commercially, and I think that's the plan going forwards. So the revenue funding that's in place and the Treasury underwrite essentially is only while we get to that stage.
Well, what you and I know, I'm not sure whether everyone out in the public knows, but you know, there are substantial amounts paid by ferry operators for the use of facilities in ports, and the 700,000 mentioned would possibly be paid for by something like the amounts that would be paid.
Yeah, and that's the idea, is it'll be fully funded in that way, so that they won't fall back on the taxpayer, because I think, like I said, we're running a commercial operation, it obviously should all pay for itself. That was the idea when the government bought the steam packet in the first place. So ultimately, it'll all be funded not by the taxpayer, but it'll all be funded out of that commercial arrangement. And I suppose the other part of the question was, are there other opportunities to develop, you know, revenue there? And there may very well be other opportunities to raise other bits of revenue from the use of the facility, and you know, that's all stuff for another day, I think, for a bigger conversation. But personally, I don't see why you wouldn't explore all those options.
And then finally, we move on to the last question you answered, and it's, well, I suppose both these questions, I think you're a member for ports and you're also a member for housing. So the housing question, this was in relation to first-time buyer support and what changes were being made. There was a little bit of spat between yourself and a former minister over what had and hadn't been done at different stages. But what exactly are you proposing with this?
So these are changes to the first-time fixed and first-time home choice scheme. So they are the two first-time buyer schemes, essentially. And there's a consultation that's live right now, so if people want the detail, go and have a look at that. But essentially, the changes are about increasing thresholds and limits and trying to make the schemes more accessible to people. That's the basis of what we're trying to do, is to open them up a bit, to change some of the things that really should have been changed already, and then to make sure going forwards these things are kind of automatically uplifted, because some of the income thresholds haven't been updated in a number of years. And there is a risk then that people suddenly don't qualify for the support schemes but can't actually afford to buy a house off their own back, so they're kind of stuck in limbo. So the intention with these changes is to try and uplift and make those schemes a bit more accessible to people. So I would encourage people to go and have a look at the consultation document, which sets it all out pretty clearly, I think.
And for the uninitiated, the income threshold matters because...
So the income threshold is how much you can earn in order to qualify for the scheme. So the idea is these schemes are targeted at low to middle income families, which is fair enough, I think. If you're earning only £30,000 a year, it's harder for you to save for a deposit and buy a house. So the schemes are designed to help people on those lower incomes. The problem is if you don't increase those thresholds, then actually as things like inflation and the cost of living get worse, it's harder then for people at higher incomes to buy a house. So you need to up the thresholds as well. And the other side of it as well is I don't think the amounts for how much you can buy for a property for have increased substantially in recent years, so they need to go up as well, because obviously property is getting more expensive. There's fewer and fewer properties out there that are available at that kind of price range. I would say, though, this is only one side of the coin. We can help, I think, and subsidise and support people at the lower end to get on the ladder, but part of the problem actually is availability of property out there, and if you just put your finger on one side of the scales, it obviously causes a problem on the other. So I do think government needs to double down and start investing in expanding its public sector housing stock and expanding the opportunities for people out there to actually buy homes. And this, like I say, this is a small part of a much bigger puzzle.
It was once described to me by a housing professional as is the game, I'm trying to remember, is it called Jack Straws, where you pull out a straw and unbeknownst to you, another straw had been balancing on that, and the next thing the whole thing collapses.
It is a bit like that, actually, and the problem you've got is every time you improve the support schemes that are available, clearly that has an impact on a live market, and so you need to understand what the market is doing before you make these changes, which goes back to the point I was making before about the wider economy, I think. So what we're doing here are primarily the technical changes, primarily to increase thresholds and limits and extending interest-free periods and the stuff that needs to happen to keep the schemes live and relevant. I do think we also need to look at making larger changes to the fundamentals of some of these schemes as well, because the shared equity approach doesn't work for everybody. I've talked in the past about needing a rent-to-buy scheme, about mortgage guarantee schemes, about other mechanisms that give people in different circumstances the same opportunity to get on the housing ladder. And I think that's kind of the next phase of work, is to say, well, how do we progress some of those other options? But in the meantime, these two schemes are what we have, and we need to make them work as well as we can.
We're nearly a quarter of the way through the final year of this administration. Why, and you know, to be fair, you were a minister for a fair portion of that. Why has it taken government so long to make some of these obvious changes in relation to trying to make it easier for people to get houses?
And I think that goes back to, as I said on the floor, you'd have to ask the previous ministers responsible for housing over the years. And the reality is, they've made some changes. Back in 2022, I think they made some tweaks to the schemes, but actually there hasn't been any real progress made. There hasn't been any real decision to build new public sector housing or new affordable housing. I mean, government have openly admitted that they built none. I think previous ministers have openly admitted that. So really, the reason it's taken us this long is because previously, I think the political leadership hasn't wanted to, despite pressure from council ministers, from other people around the table. There just hasn't been that kind of get up and go that says, right, we're going to start building homes, we're going to start investing in Manx properties, essentially. It just hasn't happened. What you've got now is a very different political approach that says, actually, we're going to do this. So yes, we only have 6 months, 7 months left now of the administration before we are closing down for the next election, and I'd like to see how much we can get done in that short period of time.
And the changes that are being proposed here for first-time buyers, when are first-time buyers likely to be able to see the benefit of these changes?
So the intention is, if when the consultation is finished, provided it doesn't throw up any massive red flags or massive spanners in the works, that we'll try and get these changes live for the 1st of April next year, so hopefully within the next 3 months, provided everything goes according to plan and provided the consultation comes back and these changes are supported, then actually it'll be relatively quick to get these changes through.
Will it need to come back to Tynwald?
I'm pretty sure the answer is yes. I'm pretty sure that the schemes are controlled by regulations which sit, which would need to come back to Tynwald. I'm not 100% sure on that, but I'm 99% sure it'll have to come back to Tynwald.
And that would be March Tynwald, I guess?
At the very latest, yeah. I mean, ideally, we'll get it done sooner. The consultation closes in the middle of January, so there's a possibility, I think, of getting something to February, but I think March is probably the most likely outcome. And obviously then, we're in Tynwald's hands if they decide to approve it, to adjourn it, to delay it, whatever it may be. That will really be up to Tynwald to decide if they want to bring those things in on time or delay them or change them or what have you.
Ramsey MHK Laurie Hooper there. Jason Moorhouse asked the question on first-time buyers.
Basically, there's a consultation out, or there's an update being proposed. What were your concerns?
I'm really concerned at the speed at which things are actually changing. Since the election, we've tried to move things in the right direction, and more constituents have got frustrated. It was a highlight of the government conference that first-time buyer schemes were going to be updated and move forward. It's now Christmas, and we get a consultation. And within the consultation, there's a section that's actually looking at new arrivals and giving them opportunities after 12 months, potentially, to have the same support as local people. And that's frustrated some people, and it came up during questioning time.
And the answers that you received, are you reasonably happy with those answers?
No, it was a case of if you've got an issue, fill up the consultation and let your thoughts be read by the officers. So it wasn't a case of we'll take back the thoughts you brought to us today and we'll consider them. It was a case of let the consultation be aware of the situation and then hopefully we will consider it. So yeah, it felt very indirect and possibly I should have stayed at home and just filled the consultation document in.
And I suppose Well, I don't know. Is question time the right time for you to give your feedback? Or well, I don't know, should there not be a meeting? Or perhaps you could put forward a motion and say, well, this is what I think should happen with first-time buyers.
Definitely, I've actually brought a motion on first-time buyers previously, just before the last election. That did kind of create a bit of momentum and we did get movement. The question today was really looking at the way in which you've got certain issues within the system that need to be considered going forward, because there was the suggestion that the changes that are within the consultation will be brought in April. So there's a short period of time from the consultation being completed to implementation. So I do think today was the opportunity to actually raise concerns. One of those is that, moreover, at least three constituents who have been knocked off the waiting list because their incomes have gone above the current level required, maximum threshold. And I raised that and said, if a new threshold comes in, which the political member suggested there would be, and it is above the current level of income of these individuals, can they rejoin the list? And I thought that was something that should be taken back to the department and considered, rather than me being one individual contributing to consultation and getting the wording rights, it's actually considered and taken forward. So it was so frustrating that that was an issue that was brought up and we were diverted back to the consultation. But hopefully, given the minister did appear halfway through the answer, she heard that and she will respond accordingly.
And it's highly likely, isn't it? I mean, if the income threshold, if you're earning too much under the current threshold and the threshold increases, then surely to goodness you'll be able to apply once the that threshold is increased and your salary then becomes lower than the threshold, which would make you eligible to apply.
Yeah, that will definitely happen. But my concern was we get backdated to actually knocked off the list, because it's kind of first come, first serve with these lists. And if you've been knocked off the list and you go back in April after the threshold has been altered, you could be 168, whereas on the original list, you could have been 19, and that might have enabled you to get one of the new houses going to be built in Castletown. So it's just kind of where you'll end up on the list and will that be considered, because it's quite a big thing for a small number of people. So it should be something that can be considered and hopefully that adjustment can be made.
So the Department of Infrastructure plan went through to in Tynwald. Why did you vote against?
It was really the format of it and the lack of detail. It was a nice picture book, and that was brought out very well by several of my colleagues. So in terms of the document itself, it wasn't really there kind of getting to the core aspects of what infrastructure is doing, their performance in terms of areas like keeping the roads up to standard in terms of the connectivity. There were links, there were highlights, which is positive, but I felt in terms of a document that was reflecting what the department is doing and where the department is going, it wasn't perhaps as focused as would have expected given the members who are in that department.
And of course you had a question down in relation to air traffic controllers. What's your concern there?
It's really Christmas is coming and just hoping that everything is in order and everything's working down there. It was quite an interesting response I got in terms of there was clarity in terms of the last 3 years has been three arrivals and three departures, but there was less clarity in terms of what there is in terms of retention. And it was rather disappointing that even though I was given that extra question at the end in terms of can the minister actually provide the answers to Tynwald members, it was a case of send me an email, which was really frustrating given that I'd asked two previous questions, and with both questions, she'd not been able to provide an answer there and then. And there's always the issue with an email that it stays private and people don't become aware of it. So I think I'll have to put in two written questions linked to the two questions that were answered. It's just kind of creating additional work and additional frustration when it could have been quickly resolved in terms of the minister was happy to answer the question, but she wanted to create another route to the answer.
That was Arbury, Castletown and Maloo MHK Jason Moorhouse. Next, Treasury Minister Alex Allenson.
You successfully managed to move your department plan There was a question, though, and I suppose not an unreasonable question, which is, what's the point of these departmental plans, bearing in mind there's only, 9 months left of this House of Keys?
In this administration, department plans were brought in right at the start, and the idea was that each of the departments would stand in front of Tynwald, tell them what they wanted to do for the year ahead, be asked questions about it, and set out, both for Tynwald and also the public, what we were doing. What we were doing with public money, what our ambitions were, what people should expect over that year. I think with all the pressures that have happened on various departments, those have lagged, and so now they're getting later and later in the day. And I'd agree with some of the members. It's sort of lost its course, lost its relevance. In fact, I remember the last session, one of the actual members actually said, "What's all this about then? You know, what's the point?" The point is that scrutiny. The point is that departments themselves should tie into the island plan and show what they're doing and should be scrutinised and then ask questions on it. I think that has relevance, but I think we do need, you know, as we get into the final year of this administration, see, can we do better next time? Can we make sure that the public know what to expect for 1 year and the year ahead, and also can Tynwald know so that they can hold us to account if we don't manage to achieve that?
Members of Tynwald did try to hold you to account, and they pointed out things like there was I think 10 million in for a new care home. We know that the last care home that was built by government cost an awful lot more than that. What's the reason behind that? If you've got various things in your capital programme up to 10 million and there's a fair to middling chance that's going to be more than that.
I mean, that was one of the aspects that we brought in this administration, was that previously things would go in the pink book and they'd be costed. And then 2 or 3 years later, they'd actually appear and they'd be far more expensive than that. And everyone would say, hang on a minute, we didn't vote for this, we didn't expect this. So what we've got now is project development funding. So money's put up front to design, to cost things, even sometimes to go out for provisional tender. So that when we arrive on the floor of Tynwald, when the departments come in wanting a new school, a new health centre, a new care home, we've got a good estimate of what they are. Now, there was a Public Accounts Committee recommendation that anything over £10 million really should be reported to Tynwald so that they knew if costs were going up, costs were going down. And what we were talking about today was Cumnel Moor, which I think when it was originally forecast was 7.7, then it went up to over 13 million, and the designs are still bubbling around. And one of the reasons for that cost inflation was that it wasn't delivered when the cost was done. We've seen huge amounts of inflation in terms of raw materials, steel, concrete, bricks. Everything has gone up in price. And so what we need to do, particularly in terms of Treasury, is go back to the department and saying, hang on a minute, is this still value for money? Because what started off as 7 million, which people thought was worthwhile, is now almost double that. Should we pause, think again about actually what we need and what we can afford, rather than just plough ahead with infrastructure projects, which when they're eventually finished, the public say, where did this come from? And so it's that explanation, that scrutiny on spending taxpayers' money, which I think is really important, so that we can make sure we maintain the trust of the public.
How do you decide which of the many competing priorities then are worthy of capital expenditure?
I mean, in some ways, it's not Treasury's position to decide whether we have a school or a hospital wing. That is up to council ministers in general. The island plan, they're all important. But what Treasury's role increasingly is seeing what's feasible, what's affordable, and what can be provided on the island. If we suddenly went ahead with 5 projects all at once, it would swamp the construction industry in the Isle of Man. And one of the feedbacks we've had is in terms of the capital programme to get a pipeline of the next 5 years so people know what's coming up, so that they can say, right, I need to invest in some apprentices. I need to invest in some machinery. And if I'm going to build a 3-storey care home in 2 years' time, tell me when it's going to come now, and then I can get prepared for that. And that's what we've been increasingly working on, get that pipeline of projects so people can see where the jobs are in the future, where the investment is necessary in the construction industry to provide for that. And I think we are getting there, but that's been through a period of really quite marked inflation on raw materials, also a lack of some of the on-island firms after a period of consolidation as well. So it's not been difficult, and that's why the overall capital programme has been delayed, because when we went out for tender on some of the key projects, the prices coming back were unaffordable and actually weren't good value for money. And so we've gone back and said, right, what can we afford and what is functional to be able to still provide those public services?
In the old days, Treasury effectively was responsible for the economy. Then we had the Department for Enterprise created, and then it kind of became gradually more and more vague as to who is responsible, and now it seems to be a kind of a shared responsibility. Is this working?
Yes, it is, but there's always been stresses. The creation of the Department for Enterprise was very much to deal directly with the industries on the island and outreach work beyond the island to new industries and new businesses to come and come here and site here. I think they've been very successful doing that. At the end of the day, if anything goes wrong, it's normally Treasury's fault, and we bear that, and we are responsible for some of the long-term economic modelling in terms of what tax receipts are going to be like, what our reserves are going to be like in the future, and also horizon scanning for some of the risks and opportunities we've got, particularly in terms of international taxation and our relationship with the outside world, particularly the UK. One of the speakers today was sort of saying, well, why don't we bring out legal aid from Treasury? Why don't we bring Social Security somewhere else? What we've tried to do in Treasury is consolidate those areas which really make a big impact to people and their pockets. We've got income tax together with national insurance. We've got Social Security and benefits together with legal aid, which is dependent, the eligibility is dependent on income. But we've also got customs and immigration in terms of securing our borders and bringing money in and having a clear customs union with the UK. So it is important that we have all these amalgamated powers, but still look at the best way of providing those services to the Isle of Man people. But the relationship with the Department for Enterprise is still very close. What we need to do, though, is make sure people get good value for money in terms of the taxpayer, that we can invest in the local economy, encourage the local economy in terms of jobs and wealth.
Why then do you think that, well, maybe you don't think, the economy doesn't seem to be booming, I think that's fair to say, and certainly the bold ambition that government had when it set off 4 years ago doesn't appear to be delivered in relation to economic growth. Why is that?
There's 101 reasons. Part of it is government policy is quite complex. Part of it is the external forces we've seen. And again, I'm not going to blame COVID and Ukraine again and again, but it has been a very difficult time for most countries around the world, and we're not immune to that. What we have had, though, on the Isle of Man is a huge amount of resilience that the Isle of Man people, the Isle of Man businesses have held up. We are treading water, and whilst people say that GDP and GMP are going down, actually they're going up. But when you look in real terms, because of the high inflation, then they haven't been keeping up with general prices, and we need to work on that. What we need to do, though, also is counter some of the pervasive negativity that's about. Things aren't brilliant. I absolutely admit to that. There are problems in terms of government finances, government funding, and we're talking at the moment about Manx Care and the stresses on that. But we are in a significantly better position than most other jurisdictions, both in terms of overall government finances, in terms of the strength and resilience of our economy, in terms of not borrowing huge amounts of money to pay for revenue. Yes, we are continuing to take down on reserves, but then we're topping up those reserves with the interest that they're accumulating. So we are in a good position. And I think going forward, you know, for the last year of this Timworld, we do need to express that, because if business confidence and consumer confidence keeps on getting knocked, we end up going down a rabbit hole that I really don't want to be in.
And you were quite robust in your summing up of your debate. Do you get a little tired, perhaps, of members giving a counter view and saying, well, maybe things aren't as good and aren't as rosy. Perhaps irritation is a little too far to go.
I mean, we live in a democracy and people are allowed to express their opinions. And I understand those opinions. People are finding it hard to make ends meet. House prices have gone up. Food prices have gone up. Eating out has gone up. Things are more expensive now than they were a couple of years ago. And that's difficult to cope with because people's wages haven't increased to the same level. But what I also know is that the Isle of Man is the best place to live and work I've ever been to. And I think we do need every now and again to get out of a bit of a tin wool bubble, speak to our constituents and actually understand how well the country has coped with everything that's been thrown at it, how well it's done in the past and how well it has to do in the future. And actually then build on the strength of our communities to make sure that our economy also prospers.
And finally then, you were accused of ignoring the will of Tynwald in relation to MiCard. Is that right?
No, I really don't think it is. We're getting a weekly update now on a transition that's been going on for 12 months. What we've been trying to do is engage with everyone who uses MiCard, and for whatever reason, some people have been very, very reluctant to do that until the last moment. So we're having to phone people up. We're actually having to send officers around to knock on doors to talk to people and say, the card that you have been using won't work after the 31st of December. How do you want to get your benefits? Because if you don't engage with us, the only alternative we've got at the moment is they send you a cheque. We've arranged that those can be cashed in a bank if you've got a bank account, or you can go to a post office and cash it there. We've tried as far as we can to work with people. For those people who have no alternatives and either don't have a bank account or can't use it, we will be rolling out new MiCards for them as an interim measure until we get a more sustainable process going forward. But again, the whole idea with MiCard is it worked for a time, but as more and more people use bank transfers, the cost of doing that per person was increasing exponentially. And it was not affordable, not good value for money for the Isle of Man taxpayers. So we need to move to a better way of doing that, but also encourage those people who don't have bank accounts for whatever reason to get one, because more and more businesses don't accept cash now, and I don't want to see them excluded from going and having a cup of coffee, taking part in local activities, or being part of our local community.
There are, though, and this is the reason why I suppose you've been under fire over the course of the last maybe 2 or 3 months, there are people on the Isle of Man who really don't want to move away from cash. Your colleague, the Enterprise Minister, answered a question in relation to making cash, making sure that cash continues to be available to people. But there are many people who perhaps have a bank account but quite enjoy having their MiCard because they like being able to have to be able to get the cash out and to spend it. And when bank branches have closed across the island, it becomes increasingly difficult for them to do that.
Yeah, and we were talking about other ways of getting cash through cash machines, through cash back. I always keep some cash in my pocket for those times when you might have to use it. And I think most people are like that. And when we also talk about the access to cash reports and the updates for that, we know that the whole world is moving towards a cashless society, but not without any use of cash. And all the studies that I've looked at show that most jurisdictions, there's around about 5 or 6% of people who will want to work with cash, who will refuse or not be able to get a bank account and will want to work with cash. And we need to be absolutely certain that we don't leave those people behind. But at the same time, that shouldn't mean that the other 94% are burdened with increased costs of trying to service that need. And so we need to get that balance right. And that's what we've been trying to do during the MiCard move from a physical card to bank accounts and alternative payment exception methods so that we can make sure that those people who really need cash get that cash locally.
December is traditionally the time when the Treasury Minister and his colleagues and Council of Ministers finalise the detail of the budget. You're still smiling, so presumably that must be a positive.
Yes, we've been working very closely with all departments to figure out what they need out of next year's budget. My first budget, I was asked to pull rabbits out of hats. There are no rabbits to pull out of hats. That's not responsible. And I've been trying to make sure that people understand that the Treasury Minister has to be in it for the long term. We have to be looking not for just next year's budget, but for the 5 years ahead of that. That's how we need to plan for this island, not giveaways that come back to haunt us in the future. But we also absolutely recognise the significant ongoing investment in the Isle of Man economy, in Isle of Man public services that's necessary to cater for our people's wishes. And I hope that when I stand up in February, people will understand the considerable time and effort that's been put in to try to get that balance right.
That was Ramsay MHK Alex Allenson. Next, the Infrastructure Minister, Michelle Hayward.
Your department plan succeeded in passing. What was in the plan?
A summary of where we've been in the last year, of the big projects that we've delivered on, some metrics around how much road we'd resurfaced and how many cat's eyes and things like that. And then a look forward to what we're delivering over the next few months as we come up towards the election time.
And there was reference in the debate to this being the final DOI plan. Presumably that's just an unfortunate choice of words by the chief exec.
It's the final plan of this administration. Department plans in the format that they're in now were a kind of a fallout from the island plan, which was one of the key things that kicked off this administration. The next administration may choose to do things in a different way, so this is the final one for this administration. I think the members that were playing little bit loose with the terminology there, trying to imply that the DOI might not exist. The DOI is always going to carry on existing.
And there were a few other issues in the plan. I mean, one of the queries that we've, or one of the issues that we've heard is, well, it was lots of nice glossy pictures, but there wasn't enough detail. But I guess if you provided lots of detail, the members would be saying there's far too much detail and we need a summary.
Yeah, and I think that's what you heard for one of the other department plans as well. There was too much detail in there. And actually, there's the comment about there not being KPIs. There are KPIs in there clearly showing trends and showing the important things that we're working towards. And you can see the seasonality of some of those, especially the travel related metrics. So, we have provided information. And I think members who, if they're interested in other KPIs, can come down and talk to us about them.
One of the other comments was in relation to local authorities, and the charge there was that the department has succeeded in uniting local authorities against the department. Is that fair?
There has been a very collegiate approach from local authorities to deal with the particular parts of the Local Government Amendment Bill, and that's fine. Actually, in between all of that, I've been out meeting with all the local authorities as we've gone round and done 20 mile an hour consultations. I met with one local authority about parking permit reviews. So actually, I'm going in and meeting and talking to local authorities all the time about a range of issues. And I think it's not fair to say that the department and local authorities are completely not talking to each other. That's not true. We have some disagreements over the Local Government Amendments Bill. That's fine. But actually, in lots of other areas, we're still carrying on working with the local authorities as we always have done.
And to be fair, the clause that local authorities seem to have most concern about wasn't even a department clause or amendment.
No, it wasn't a department amendment. It was something that was moved by a private member who by then had become a member of the department, but it was drafted, as we heard in the evidence to Legco, well before he was invited to join the department, before I was minister even.
Russian MHK Michelle Hayward there. Finally, Chris Thomas.
So where do we go from here in relation to both the hydrocarbon debate and I suppose also the net zero debate? Is this going to be a bigger election issue, do you think, this time round?
Very much so. And I've also started it on the other front, which is that government's not telling us anything about the offshore wind farm in particular, also to an extent about the onshore wind farm, but particularly on the offshore wind farm. It wasn't signed by a politician, it was signed by a chief officer, and no politician had seen it until Dr. Allenson saw it in 2022, apparently, as part of the economic strategy work when they were working with a consultant to think about another offshore wind field. And I was quite surprised because I was the Minister of Infrastructure responsible and I didn't see it when Dr. Allenson saw it, so I'm going to raise some questions about that. And then more recently when I asked questions in the summer, Dr. Hayward asked to see it, and once you saw it. I never actually asked to see it formally by saying to the chief officer, show it to me or else. What I did was a number of times in meetings, I asked if I could see it. And I was told things like by various officers, well, no politician previously had seen it. And I checked with Orsted whether I could receive it from them. And I was told previously that, you know, they hadn't shared it. And obviously there was a freedom of information discussion about the agreement for lease over the winter, last winter. And I had talked with various politicians who've been involved in the past to see whether they'd seen this agreement for lease. So I formed a view it wasn't widely available. I'm glad now that Dr. Hayward and Dr. Allenson have seen it. And I've got a question down in Keys next week that if all other politicians can see it on the same basis that they've seen it.
And why wouldn't politicians be allowed to see this agreement, bearing in mind the potential significant value to the Manx economy that could arise from it?
Exactly, and the ministers have made their situation worse from defending that decision today, because if we're going to choose what happens in our territorial seas, we've got to know about the economic returns and the fiscal returns as well as the impacts on the climate change, given that it's now quite clear that we've got a proven gas reserve and we've got gas as a transition fuel. We've got hundreds of millions of pounds of gas infrastructure. The debates on, the discussions on the general election is coming soon, and this will be a major issue in the election.
That was Douglas Central MHK Chris Thomas. So what do you think? Lots to ponder in the world of Manx politics, but perhaps contemplating a happy and peaceful Christmas is higher on your list. I'm Phil Gorn. Go to Myers and Geist. Thanks for listening.